Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I use that term very loosely with this group, but because now I've got to know you, so there you go. And so it's really good to be here. I just really enjoyed last night spending time with you guys, and I know we're going to have a great day today. I happy birthday, John. 9 years. I know you're a picture of humility and don't want to recognize that, but I love you, and I know the guys at this retreat love you a lot, brother. And you're a big piece of what happens around here in your home group, and I'm grateful for that. So big anniversaries are always a big deal because shows the new guy it's possible, you know. So anyway, congratulations, man. I got back to my room last night, and I had my phone on, which I better put out here so I have my timer on, because I heard the rule, John. So I got back to my room, had it on Do Not Disturb, so I don't get any ringing in. I took it off, and I had a voicemail, and a guy back home had called me, and obviously drunk, because I can't discern his name. And I called him back, and he's my wife sponsors his girlfriend, and so apparently my number got passed along, and he begins to have this conversation with me. And I don't usually talk to wet drunks, by the way, because what good is it? But I can listen, right? I can listen. And he began to tell me about his bad luck, and I said, what do you mean by bad luck? And he starts to tell me about the cars he's wrecked, you know, that we're going to jail. And I'm beginning to hear it's a lot of misunderstanding. So he's got that, and he starts drinking, is just going to have one. He had 2 6-packs, and he just tells me this tale of woe. And I said, Kyle, I got good news for you, man. He goes, what is it? I go, it's not bad luck. It's not bad luck. He said, what is it? I said, alcoholism. That's what it is. He goes, what's good about that? I said, we got a solution for that. You know, I don't know about bad luck. I don't have much solution for that. I got a solution for alcoholism. And I said, look, is there any more booze in the house? No, I don't have any more here, which probably means he's got a fifth. And maybe an eight ball somewhere. I don't know. I said, well, look, just try to go to bed tonight, and I'll send a couple of guys tomorrow to get you. They'll take you. They'll sit down with you, and they'll talk to you about some stuff. And if you want to go to the meeting, they'll take you. And I hung up. And about 2 minutes later, he called back. And he said, thank you for calling me back. He said, the guy used to, when I would go to meetings, I had a guy that I called sponsor, and he said I'd call him, and he wouldn't call me back. And I didn't think AA worked. And I said, Kyle, AA works perfectly. It's people that are flawed. It's people that are flawed. But AA is a perfect program when applied. So you get some sleep. I'll send the guys tomorrow, and it'll be good. And that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I mean, that's the beauty of AA. We transmit it because we're willing. And so we talked last night about God, this power, and having some hope that whatever we do, whatever the people in front of us are doing will work for us. Silkworth talked about an entire psychic change. Now, that sounds a lot more to me than just not drinking. But early on, I mean, I think Alcoholics Anonymous is the biggest bait and switch program there is. You know, we suck you in because you're drinking. Okay, come in here. And then after about a week, we say, you know, the bad news, drinking is really not your problem, you know. Although the entire world has told us, drink, you got a drinking problem, you got a drinking problem. And then we come to AA and find out that drinking is not our problem. It's a symptom of what something else happening with us, this disturbance that we have inside of us. I always tell new people, listen, don't go back and tell your wife, your mom and dad, or whoever that it ain't that, hey, those AA guys said I don't have a drinking problem. They'll hunt me down, right? Because it certainly looks to them like a drinking problem. But it's this spiritual problem, and it's when we talk about an entire psychic change, you know, that's a lifelong process. Step 10 talks to us about you should continue for a lifetime. I can't just come here and get some, I can't follow the recipe, bake a cake, and go home. It's not, you know, I don't check the boxes, take the steps, and I'm cured. I can't do that. I mean, everybody in this room has known people who've come to AA, come here, taken the 12 steps, had an awakening, had something good happen to them, And slowly but surely go back asleep in AA and walk right out our door and they never come back here. And so the big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, I believe this with all my heart. If you had a monkey with cue cards and you wanted to get sober, a monkey would hold the cue card up and say, do this, do this, do this. You'll have an awakening. The steps are designed because when the book was written, AA existed in Akron, New York, and a few satellite places in New Jersey, Cleveland. I mean, it was it. The idea was the book would go out. You would get the book, you would read it, take the actions in the book, you'd have an awakening. So a monkey with cue cards, if you're desperate enough, monkey with cue cards, you do the actions. It's a Betty Crocker cake recipe. If I follow the directions on the back of a Betty Crocker cake mix, if I do exactly what it says, put it in the oven for the prescribed time, at the end of that time, I'm going to take a cake out that Miss Crocker herself would be proud of, right? But if I take that box and I take the cake mix and I look at it, it says, well, it says 2 eggs, but I'm going to put 4 in today, right? It says 30 minutes at 250, but I'm just going to do it for 90 meetings in 90 days and slide it right in there, man, you know. At the end of that prescribed time, I'm going to have something, but it's not going to be a Betty Crocker cake. And if I do something other than what's outlined in this book, I'm going to have something, but it's not going to be the design for living that's prescribed by our book. And so we have hope here. We come here, we find some kind of hope. But there's somewhere in here I've got to figure out, am I looking here for something, not just a participation in a fellowship, but real recovery? Because oftentimes we can be confused about participating in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and substitute activities for action. I could come to Alcoholics Anonymous and get caught up in the fellowship here, sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and think I'm doing good. Trying to live on the fellowship, you know. It's kind of like the traditions, you know, practicing the traditions, hoping the steps come true, that kind of deal, you know. I've got to come here hoping AA rubs off on me, hoping I sit in meetings and something rubs off on me. I can tell you, if you sit in meetings, if you're a real alcoholic, and all you do is sitting in meetings and Alcoholics Anonymous, my experience is this, something will rub off on you, death. Slowly but surely, what happens to the real alcoholic is alcoholism begins to pervade me again, and I begin to take actions contrary to what the principles they're talking about in there. And I get restless, irritable, discontented again. And I might not drink, but I begin to take all kind of actions to substitute for that feeling inside, that missing piece, what some people talk about, the hole in the soul. I heard that talk about a lot. I used to believe that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll talk about it more later. But what we're talking about here is some kind of deepening a relationship with a power, is finding something that works in my life, trying to find something. You know, we talk about God here a lot. Dr. Bob talked about in his story at the end, he says, if you don't believe, I feel sorry for you. We softened that in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when we wrote the book, we softened that stance because people come here with prejudices. Howard P. from Arizona. Some of you guys might have known Howard or certainly heard Howard. Howard used to talk about baby elephant ideas, which was one of my favorite stories that Howard told. Howard, when he was a little boy, he watched this newsreel at the movie theater about how they trained elephants. And they would take a baby elephant and take a well rope and tie it to the baby elephant's leg and then tie it to a big tree. And the baby elephant would pull and pull and pull, and finally it would break its will and believe when the rope got tight, he can't escape, so he just gave up. And that's why if you ever go to a circus or a little county fair or whatever, and they got elephants, they just got like a little regular rope on an elephant tied to a stake that a mouse could pull out. And when the elephant sways and it gets tight, he moves back. And it's not the stake that holds the elephant. It's not the rope that holds the elephant. It's the limiting idea that when the rope gets tight, I can't go. And I'm full of those when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm full of baby elephant ideas. That these limiting things in my life limit me. That when I pull on the rope, it gets tight, I can't escape. And what I have to do here is I have to find a way to let go of fear, old ideas. I got to find something in my life, some kind of power that I can rely on. And the guys in front of me who demonstrate that are critical to me. critical to me to foster some kind of hope. In our book, it talks about a transition from hope to faith. Faith in something, some kind of idea. I watched a program one time. I caught it on like one of the educational channels. It was obviously a weak moment, and I'm looking for something, right? And so, and they were interviewing people. And they interviewed adults first, men and women. And they said, you know, if you could change anything about you, what would you change? And so they had the ladies first. And they were saying things like, well, if I had bigger boobs, I'd take my, you know, my nose. And so they're going through this all litany of how they could change the exterior to make it more appealing when they look in the mirror. Men the same way. If I was taller, lose my belly, you know, all this stuff. They're looking for ways to look in the mirror to be more appealing to what society says they should look like. Then they interviewed kids. And they interviewed these kids, and they would say things like, if you could change anything about you, if you could change anything about your body, what would you do? But so these are little 5 and 6 year old kids. And this was their answer. Well, if I could change anything, I'd have fairy wings so that I could fly over and see my friends and, you know, oh, no, 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 I want Dumbo ears so I could take off. And so their imagination just ran wild. Free spirited, not anchored down by the old ideas, trappings of the world, right? Not limited by the worldly clamor that we all find and foster once we get here. And so I'm convinced about this. I bet you that the majority of the men in this room today have had something like this said to them their entire life. You need to grow up. You need to grow up. You need to grow up. That's what your problem is. You don't grow up. And to some sense, they're right. The 12 of 12, it talks about, psychologists says we're childlike. You know? We're childlike. We're selfish, self-centered. We want what we want when we want. But I believe when we get here, something different has to happen to us. It's my experience, once I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, the idea that here we have to grow down spiritually to the faith of a child. And I bet you everybody in this room has seen something like this somewhere you've been, and you've been with your child or a nephew or a niece or something, a friend's kid, and there'll be some kind of ledge or they'll be on a stoop or a stair, and their parents come by or you come by, and they look at you or they look at their parents and say, catch me, and they just jump. They don't wait. They don't wait for the parent to get ready, you know, all right, now jump. They say, catch me, and they jump. Why? Because they have absolute faith that the person they're jumping to is going to catch them. Absolute faith. The belief that when I jump, that person is going to catch me. They don't wait. And here in Alcoholics Anonymous, when we get here, when we're the one thing that we've lost, the one thing that's keeping us alive, booze or drugs. That's the thing. You know, booze and drugs kept me alive long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that. Absolutely believe that. And when we get here, we're asked to give up the one thing that makes us feel like we're okay. Trouble with that is turned on us. Bill described it as a boomerang in flight, you know, that it almost cut me to ribbons. And so we come here and we're saying we treat the symptom, we take the booze away, and now we're just raw. And the trouble with being raw is sobriety becomes untenable for the real alcoholic. Just don't drink and go to meetings will kill a guy like me, because death rubs off on me. And I begin to think, woulda, coulda, shoulda, restless, irritable, discontent, four horsemen all over me. We talk about it here, hope. We will demonstrate to the newcomer 30, 60, 90 days, they get this thought that, man, I haven't drank, something's working here, and they begin to develop some faith that this may work. Hope transitions to faith. The book talks about we step from bridge to shore. Talks about all of our life we've relied on some kind of faith of our own thinking. Right? Of my own thinking, I've depended on. If I can just think my way out of this, if I can just come up with another idea. And somehow we believe that, but we see these demonstrations here. We watch people in Alcoholics Anonymous, see them make the demonstrations. They share their stories. We're a society of storytellers here. We trade, it's the coin of the realm in Alcoholics Anonymous. We trade on stories. And when you're new here, you're asked to share in that. You're asked to come here and share in our experiences. Come be part of it. But what you figure out after a while is, I'm not really going to get to share if I don't take some action and do the things they're talking about. I can't really share about step three. I can't really share about step four till I take some actions contrary to what I might believe. I can't really talk about amends unless I do some of those. I can't really come and participate. I can say I'm a member, but I can't really participate and have any kind of experience that's worth trading until I can do that. Because we are the players, you know. You can shit the fans, but you can't shit the players, man. I mean, we know. If you're here, we know. We separate the bullshit from the ice cream quickly here, right? I mean, we know. We know. And so we figure out in order to participate in this fellowship that we have to take some actions because we find the first place we belong. But not only that, in order to survive here, we have to do some. I was about 30 days sober, and my wife came to me and she said, listen, they're having this deal, the history of the Catholic Church at the church that we attend, Easter and Christmas. She said, listen, they're having this deal. Before I got sober. The history of the Catholic Church, and I'd like for you to go. I'm 30 days sober. And see, I'm a model AA student at this point. And I said, well, when is it? She said, it's Sunday night. It starts at 6. It's 2 hours over at 8. I'd like you to go with me. And at that time, the home group that I belonged to met on Sunday night, 5:30 to 6:30. And I said, well, honey, I can't go. It's my home group night. Now, I want to tell you, those 30 days that I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, Don, he was a guy that when he carried a beneficial message to me, he looked at me and he said, Cliff, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear a lot of crazy things. You'll hear things like just don't drink, go to meetings. You do 90 meetings in 90 days. That these are suggestions. He said, that'll kill a real alcoholic. He said, and you're a real alcoholic. He said, it'll kill you. He said, so you need some requirements. He said, the first requirement is, he said, you got to call me every day. You got a phone. And I pulled this flip phone out that Lori was paying for. And I put his number in there, you know. I called him every day. And he said, you need to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And I thought, man, you know, I hadn't worked in 3 years, but I'm thinking, I'm pretty busy. I got some underwear drawers to straighten up. I got some stuff going on, you know. But he said, you don't know where the good meetings are, so I'm going to come get you. And old Don lived about a mile and a half from me. He had to come by kind of my neighborhood to go to the meetings. He said, you don't know where the good meetings are, so I'm going to come get you. And what Don did, he would come get me every day. He'd come get me at 11:15 because we'd go to the noon meeting. We had to be there at 11:30 because if you're not there 30 minutes early, you're late. And he'd come get me at 4:45 for the 5:30 meeting. We'd leave there, go eat dinner. We'd go to a 7 o'clock step tradition study. And so he set up a milk route for me that every day I was going to these meetings, and he didn't let me go. He took me to step studies, literature-based meetings, tradition meetings, none of this issue with tissue meetings, no open topic discussion, no dead dog meeting, nothing like that, you know. We went to where the solution was, so he set up this milk route that I knew where to go. I knew where to take, where I went to get the cream. And the last thing he said was this. He said, now this is the deal breaker. He said, whenever I ask you to do something, you don't need to come back tomorrow and share how that makes you feel. You know, you don't need to give me any input about that. He said, when I ask you to do something, if you can't do that, I can't help you. And he made a little faint like he was leaving, like he was getting up. And it scared me to death. And I agreed. Right there on the spot, I made a pact with the devil, man, right there, you know. I agreed. Whatever he asked me to do, I'd do. And so I had this conversation with Lori on Sunday. And the deal's starting the next week. So that night, I'm with Don, and I'm telling the woes of the day. Because at 30 days sober, you got all kind of woes. I mean, you ain't working, you're not doing nothing, but you got problems. I mean, I'm telling you, you got problems. And I'm giving him the woes of the day. And then I start talking about what Lori wants to do. But what I really want to do is I'm going to tell him this story about Lori, about the deal at the church, and I'm going to tell him, but I told her no. And what I want Don to do is to say, my God, you're a model AA student. I want him to go to the home group and say, hey, let me tell you this story about Cliff and advance him a couple of days on his sobriety is really what I want. Back me up a couple of days. You know, I've never had a sponsoree that followed this much direction, really. It's the resurrected powers of the alcoholic ego. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. It's deadly. Really deadly. And so I tell Don the old, you know, my woe, and I tell him Lori's story, and he goes, tell me the thing about Lori again. And I thought, my God, he is old. And so I tell him again, Sunday night, church, 2 hours, home group, can't go. And he just looked at me, and he said, well, that's where you're wrong. That's where you're wrong. He said, you know, that woman saved your life. And if that's what she wants to do, we're going to do that. Now, when he said we are, I knew that meant me. He wasn't. I mean, me. We're going to do that. And Don was big on teachable moments. You know, he'd like to just you experience a lesson rather than explain it to you. And I think that's so important here. We get to have our own experiences. You know, we get direction from our sponsors, and we take action on that to have an experience. Alcoholics Anonymous, much like what I've discovered God is here, is experiential. I have to have my own experience. You know, I can't live off John's experience. I can hear about it. I can't live off that. I can hear about Andy's experience, but I can't live off that. Gotta have my own experience. I can hear that and I can internalize it, and then I gotta go have my own. That's how AA works. It's not a program by osmosis. I just can't come here and sit and hope I get it. You know, death rubs off on me here. And so Don tells me that. You know, he gives me some pretty clear-cut direction of what he wants me to do. So I go back to Lori. And I say, listen, I've been thinking about that, and I think I can do that. Varying degrees of rigorous honesty here, right? And so I went. And this particular deal was being taught by probably the oldest priest on earth, really. He's like Methuselah, you know, like the old Father Mama. I got to go to his wake when he passed away. And Father Mahlon was old. He was kind of cranky, as old priests are, you know. If you haven't been laid in that long a time, you're pretty cranky, you know. So, by the way, no biological materials in my room today, just so everybody knows. And I took all my snack stuff and paid the trash and brought it over here so nobody would find snacks in my room, by the way. So Father Mahlon, he would kind of lecture for like 50 minutes. Then there would be a snack break, which is huge, you know, and then he'd do another 50 minutes. And so it's like the second Sunday, the second hour. And Father Mahlon always told these dad jokes, which we all know are stupid. But at 30 days sober, they're hilarious. I mean, and so what happens is I'm at this, you know, we're in this kind of like this in a little room at the church, and it's late September, and the air conditioner's just turned into the heater, right, in Oklahoma. And so I get in these comfortable chairs, and what I do, if I get somewhere comfortable and the temperature is just right, I just go right out. I got no problem just dozing right off, right? And it's the second Sunday, the second hour. We're coming back from snacks. Father Mahlon starts talking. I think he's going to tell a joke, so I listen because I want to hear the joke. Then I'll just rack out. And he says this. When I was a little boy growing up in Chicago, where I went to play, where I went to school, where I went to go see my friends, I had to cross a cemetery. He said, that's no big deal, crossing a cemetery. Not a big deal at all. He said, except at night. He said, at night, I would get to the edge of the cemetery and be terrified. Because in my mind's eye, as I'm looking through the cemetery, I'm imagining dead people coming out of the ground. The trees are monstrous. He said, I would be terrified. He said, so I would hit that cemetery gate and I would run as fast as I could, terrified, hoping nothing got me. He said, but if I ever got to the edge of that cemetery at night and my daddy was with me, he said, you know what? I just put my hand in my daddy's hand. And I'd puff my chest out, and we would walk through that cemetery knowing for a fact that nothing was going to get me and that everything was going to be all right. And I swear to God, he looked right at me and said, that's how God is. And for the very first time in my life, I heard that. And the next thing he said was this. He said, God is your number one fan. And I love that because I could imagine God up there with a big foam rubber, number one, go Clint, baby. Everything changed for me. Everything changed in an instant. The beautiful thing about sponsorship direction, they've been where I'm going. Don had no idea what was going to happen to me. He had no idea that when he sent me there, that I was going to get some kind of identification about a power. He didn't know when he sent me there that I could make a decision to turn my will and my life over to that. What he knew was that it was a teachable moment and that I would have an experience if I went and I needed to do something for somebody else in my life that what they wanted to do. It was a deal in selflessness. Go do what she wants to do because she wants to do it. I don't care if you get a thing out of it. You're going because she wants to do that, and you're going to go. That was the message. Be selfless. Do something what she wants to do, you selfish bastard, right? Mm-hmm. Do that. He didn't know what was going to happen, but he knew the lesson was there. That's how sponsorship works. Don't always know what's going to happen. We just know if we take action contrary to how we think, feel, and believe, we have an opportunity to grow here. Contrary to how I think, feel, and believe. Because before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, my whole life is ruled by how I think, feel, and believe. I'm burdened with old ideas, baby elephant ideas, that hold me captive and prisoner. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous as a racist and a homophobe from a little small hick town. Little bitty small hick town. It's just how it was. And what's happened for me is this amazing transformation. I go back to Don the next day, and I share that experience with him. And what he did was he kicked the ottoman out, because I'd go over on Mondays before Monday Night Football. He would kick the ottoman out, and he got down on his knees, and he got the book out. And he turned it to the third step prayer. Now, I want to tell you about my home group that I went to at the time that Don had been a member of for 10 years. In that group, every time they opened the meeting, they opened with the Serenity Prayer and the third step prayer. They closed with the seventh step prayer and the Lord's Prayer. Don had been going there for 10 years, 52 weeks a year times 10. He'd been to 520 meetings at that group where they said the third step prayer. He knew it. He knew the prayer. Yet he got the book out and he's been on his knees beside me and he said, let's say the prayer together, shoulder to shoulder. He knew the prayer, but yet he read it with me. The symbolism, what we do here. No one's better than the other. Don on his knees with me reading the prayer. It was the imagery in that day that it didn't have full impact on me till later. That Don could have just been on the other side, the opposite side of the ottoman, saying the prayer by rote because he knew it, but yet he chose to be beside me, holding my hand, reading the prayer with me. That we're the same, that we're equal, that I'm not over here and you're over there. We're shoulder to shoulder doing this together. And it was not lost on me later on as I reflected on that is that what Don did for me that day. was he made it be okay for me to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That I was just one among many, which I could never be. I want to be better than everybody. Walk into a room, feel less than everybody. Walk into a room, start taking everybody's inventory, trying to figure out how do I fit in, who's in charge, because I got to figure out who's in charge to get what I need. And on that day, what happened is that my whole script flipped. When we look at the third step prayer, we look at what it really talks about for a guy like me. And this is just about me. You may have your own experience with this. It talks about relieve me of the bondage of self. We're talking about slavery. I've been a slave to self. Self has drugged me around because of what I think, feel, and believe. I'm a slave to self. Somebody talked about it. We never entirely get rid of self. It's the human condition. I can't get away from me. So what I have to do is take actions contrary to how I think, feel, and believe. I can't. What do we always hear today? I can't think my way into right action. I've got to act my way into right thinking. I begin to take actions contrary to that. What I want is to be loved, comforted, and understand. What I have to do is take actions to love you, comfort you, and try to understand you. And so in this process, what happened for me that day is this: the beginnings of an awakening here. The beginnings of cracking my eye and listening to what Don had to say, reading that book, and realizing how I had assigned roles to people my entire life. How I had been a guy that had conditions on everything, that my whole relationships with everybody was transactional. What can you do for me? You know, I'm like the Godfather. Someday I may ask you to do a favor for me. And I know all you native Floridians from New York and New Jersey get that, right? I mean, so,
or Chicago.
Or whatever, right? I've never met anybody really from Florida, but I'm saying.
One guy,
a couple of guys. In a room of 3,000, two people, that's it. And so we begin this awakening here. And we transition to come to believe that a power can restore us to some kind of sanity. This idea that if I drink and take a drink, it's going to be different this time. And here's how. And so we come to this spot where we try to form some kind of idea. And I can tell you, that idea as a brand new member of Alcoholics Anonymous, just getting here, that idea of the father and the child. And the third step talks about it in our textbook. It talks about the relationship with us and the power. That the power's here and I'm here. Director, actor, parent, child, employer, employee. The trouble with me my whole life is I start out really trying to be really humble, but before long, I want to try to tell God how to do his business. You know, most people are willing to serve God, but only in an advisory capacity, right? I mean, that's how that works. And here what has to happen is I have to find myself into some degree of initial humility to be subservient to that power. In the original text, when it got to that part, they took this out, 1935, before it was published. They took this part out. It said, when it talked about the relationship, parent-child, it said this: get this simple idea straight. Get this simple idea straight. Where is our relative position in here? They took that out. They thought it was too harsh. Maybe not harsh enough, I say. Get this simple idea straight. But that idea of the parent and the child, early on in my sobriety, served me well. Because I could identify that. It was something I could visualize and see. And I can tell you, that idea has grown and changed. When I really got the book and began to study the book, my sponsor was a guy that was a book guy. He said, you should read the book 4 or 5 times and then start studying it. And break it down. And you know, for the last 16 years at my house, I run a book study on Tuesday night. We go by the book line by line. We are in no hurry. We may not get through the book in a year. We just take our time. Sometimes we talk about a paragraph and next week come back, talk about it some more. We're not in any hurry because I believe the book is meant to be studied. And I can tell you that idea that I can't neither comprehend nor define God. But I can tell you on some days when the fecal matter hits the oscillator, right? I got to revert back to a simple idea to put my hand in my Father's hand and it's okay. That I'm going to be okay. The relative idea that it's not okay out there, but I can be okay no matter what. That's a foreign concept to me. Because I believe what's happening out there is directly, it's personal to me. But that's not necessarily so. It's just what is, and I'm okay. So, thanks, guys.